Hello, and welcome to episode 66 of the Movie Marathoners Podcast, part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mati, and joining me today, returning to the podcast, is Brett Bohan from Bohan Reviews. Welcome back to the podcast, Brett. How's this fall season been for you?
It's not been bad. I've been, you know, that meme of the dog sitting at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee and everything's on fire around him?
Yeah.
And he's just saying, this is fine. It's kind of how it feels right now. But I went back and I listened to our the one and only Ivan review, and just listening to my voice in that podcast, it's just like, oh, this is what a month and a half of law school does to you. So you know, it's getting under my belt and I'm getting used to it, but it's still a lot. So how's the fall season for you so far?
Can't complain too much in the grand scheme of things. I feel like the dog sitting in the room on fire is just what everybody feels like nowadays. So
yeah.
I think I'm fortunate enough that my fire is a little bit lower than the average fire. So can't complain too much. But here we are, fall season. We would be gearing up for Oscars and award ceremony, but we're kind of getting that truncated slash elongated slash who knows what's happening. But we've got a great movie here, and it will probably contend for Oscars. So let's start talking about it. You alluded to previously, Brett, that you were on the podcast for The One and Only Ivan. We also reviewed before that Artemis Fowl. I actually liked The One and Only Ivan, but you weren't too hot on either of those films. So hopefully we're changing the tide this week because we are reviewing Aaron Sorkin's new Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago 7. We'll warm up by giving our spoiler-free thoughts on the film, and then we'll run into spoiler territory. And as usual, we'll finish up with our point two section where we talk about what else we've been watching. So let's start with a synopsis of The Trial of the Chicago 7. The story of seven people on trial stemming from various charges surrounding the uprising at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois. The Trial of the Chicago 7 stars just about everyone. We've got Sacha Baron Cohen, Eddie Redmayne, Jeremy Strong, Mark Rylance, and Yahya Abdul-Mateen II, just to name a few. And it is written and directed by Aaron Sorkin.
When we walked in here this morning, they were chanting that the whole world is watching.
If we leave here without saying anything about why we came in the first place, it'll be heartbreaking.
Last summer, why did you come to the convention?
To end the war.
We're giving them exactly what they want, a stage and an audience.
Yeah, you really think there's going to be a big audience? Here I am!
This is what revolution looks like, real revolution.
We may have to hurt somebody's feelings.
Is this prosecution politically motivated?
I'm tired of hearing you.
It would be impossible for me to care any less what you are tired of. Here I am!
To find some courage now.
Now, how much is it worth to you? What's your price?
To call off the revolution?
My life.
So, Brett, I don't want to bury the lead here. I'm just dying to know, did we break the streak? Did you enjoy the trial of the Chicago 7?
I did enjoy the trial of the Chicago 7. and so, yes, we did finally break the streak of movies that I didn't quite care for. But I do know, I'm fairly certain that I'm a little lower on this one than you are still. So there's still room for improvement, I think.
Yeah. No, that's fair. And I should get it out of the way. I loved this movie. I thought it was definitely one of the best movies of the year, if not the best movie of the year. And maybe that's a bit hyperbolic, but who cares? We're in quarantine. I can be hyperbolic if I want to.
I mean, the way this year has been so far anyway, especially in terms of movies and just the wildly swinging, you know, how good the movies are. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's okay to be a little hyperbolic.
Yeah. And I mean, in the grand scheme of movie years, it's kind of a low bar to clear to be one of the best movies of the year, just because there's been like seven movies this year. But before I talk a little bit about why I love it so much, let me just ask, you are an educated individual who is pursuing a degree in lawyership? Is that what you call it? I don't know. But was this a story that you were previously aware of? Like, does the Chicago 7 mean something to you outside of this story?
No, I hadn't heard of this before. And it's kind of surprising that I hadn't after doing some research on it and how important this event kind of is historically and also even in, you know, even in the sphere of you know, popular media, there have been several film versions of this that have been done before. So I was surprised to learn all that after having seen this, but no, it wasn't something I was familiar with.
Yeah, same here. This was a brand new story for me. The script for this film was actually first written in 2007. So Aaron Sorkin had been attached for a long time for this film, and it was originally going to be directed by Steven Spielberg, who I think even at these later stages was a big part of how this movie got made. But the original cast of this was going to be Sacha Baron Cohen. He was always going to be Abby Hoffman. We were going to have Will Smith as Bobby Seale, and we were going to have Heath Ledger as Tom Hayden. And then when it was resurrected again, we were going to have Seth Rogen play Jerry Rubin, who was eventually replaced with Jeremy Strong. And Jonathan Majors was going to play Bobby Seale before he stepped down, and it was replaced with Yahya Abdul-Mateen. So this movie, I don't know if, you know, development hell is the word for it, but it took 13 years for it to get on the screen. And of course, we know that it didn't quite make it to the screen, so to say. This is a Netflix film. But was it worth the wait? Do you want to just tell me a little bit about what you thought about the film?
Overall, I'm a little conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
As a film, I will say that I really, really liked it. I think it was just incredibly entertaining. Obviously, it's Aaron Sorkin. He's got that really witty back and forth writing and speech style that, of course, goes really well with this type of film. But there are a lot of things to like about it, but there are also a lot of things that I think I just wasn't quite able to connect with. And then just the more that I learned about this real story and sort of diving into the actual transcripts of the hearing of the trial, I sort of had trouble reconciling the differences that Aaron Sorkin took with this. And so when I watched it on the second time round, I tried to watch it to understand why he changed the things that he did. Like I said, I think it's very entertaining. I think that this is a film that is very much for today. It's very much of the time. And to hear that it's written in 2007, it feels so timely that it doesn't seem like it should have been written that long ago. But yeah, there's a lot to like here, but I do have my hesitations.
Yeah, perfectly fair. I think what really worked for me in the film was the script, and then just as a movie experience, like you're saying, I think it is just a wonderful 2 hours, I would say, at the theaters, but, you know, on your couch, whatever. It's a really fun film. It's a really funny film. And I think just everybody is kind of working at 100%. All the actors are fantastic. I think some of the accents could use a little work, but I would say those are nitpicks.
You're from Boston, right?
Yeah, I'm from Boston. Not originally, so I cannot claim to know an authentic Boston accent, but So the first time I watched this, I just assumed he was not from Boston. I assumed he was doing some other random ass accent that I've never heard of. And then learning that it's a Boston accent, I'm like, okay, sometimes your British is coming out. But I do think that in terms of how that affects the movie, it's relatively negligible.
Yeah, I agree.
And I also think, you know, you've got great performances from Jeremy Strong. He is also doing, I wouldn't say an accent, but a voice that sounds a little wonky to me.
I've got to say, like, I don't agree with the choice that Jeremy Strong made with that voice. I don't think it worked, but he's consistent. Like, it's the same throughout the entire film. So he went with it. I just don't know if it was the right choice.
Yeah, he's definitely doing something. And I can appreciate the choice to commit to something. I agree. I like his performance overall, but the voice is a little weird for me. But where I think this film just really works is that just from, you know, second one, it roars to life. And then it just doesn't slow down. Like you've got the opening montage introducing each of the members. I think how it frames everything, regardless of whether it's historically accurate or not, which we can talk about in a bit. But the way that it introduces each of the individuals in this trial and the way that it kind of juxtaposes them against each other and the way that it's quickly giving you character traits for each of them, I think is just such a blast. And it all happens in like 5 minutes before the title card.
I agree with that. And I think, I don't know if we want to get into this yet or do it a little bit later, but I think the fact that pretty much, I mean, you get that opening sort of montage sequence with everybody preparing to go to Chicago. But other than that, this is all like in the courtroom, all of the flashback stuff is testimony that people are given. And so we're just thrown right into it, like you said, right from the beginning. And so, you know, we don't have all of that getting set up that you often see in courtroom dramas. You just get right into the actual trial. And I think that works really well.
Yeah. And I love the way that they interweave the flashbacks with the testimony. Like, you're never learning something outside of a witness being on the witness stand. And I think that kind of makes, I mean, maybe you can correct me, but I think it makes it a little more realistic in like the proceedings of the courtroom, while also still making it entertaining and have drama and stakes to it, because you're going back to seeing what happens. You can tell who's lying on the stand because of what you're seeing in the flashbacks. All of these things, I think, make for a really engaging story. And I think one of the great things about courtroom dramas is that at their raw essence, they are the easiest form of storytelling. You've got good guys and bad guys. And there's always somebody that you know you're rooting for, and there's somebody that you know you're rooting against. And this movie's no different. It's really easy to say, hey, we want to vindicate the Chicago Seven. There's never a question about like, oh, were they really doing the wrong thing? Do they deserve some of this? No, it's all like, you know, kind of fuck the government and the establishment that's raining down on these individuals. And I mean, maybe there should be more complexity, but for me, that's why I kind of love the courtroom drama and why I think this movie works really well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. As far as being able to correct you or not, I haven't taken a civil procedure or a criminal procedure or a trial advocacy class yet, so I don't have all of that sort of stuff down. The one thing that I will say about what this film does is I do appreciate that we get the testimony sort of juxtaposed against the reality, and we get to see how testimony can be spun or just flat out lying in order to tell a different story. And that's sort of something that I've that's been pressed a little bit, at least so far in law school, is that what's written in the opinion isn't always the reality of the situation. And so that's something you have to keep in mind.
So has being in law school already, I mean, you're only in your first year, so you've got plenty coming to you, but has that already affected your ability to kind of suspend disbelief during courtroom dramas or legal dramas, thrillers, whatever?
I wouldn't say so, no, because I think a lot of what people dislike, a lot of what lawyers dislike about lawyer movies is sort of the procedural aspects of law. And so, you know, we talked about it when we were talking about A Few Good Men, when Tom Cruise just rips the manual out of the other lawyer's hands. That would clearly never happen in a real courtroom. And just, you know, walking around just doesn't really happen. You know, you do most of your argument from behind a podium. So, I mean, that's sort of the thing that people latch onto, and procedural stuff in this film for sure probably irks lawyers because the procedure is so all over the place. But I also, you know, looking at the transcripts and just based on how story actually went, it doesn't sound like a lot of procedure was followed very well anyway. So I think, you know, maybe this is one that you might get angry with as a lawyer, but I'm not sure that it's valid. But, you know, it's still early on. So right now I can still enjoy legal dramas, but we'll see, you know, in 3 years if that's still the case.
Yeah, I think it's really funny how unprocedural the characters act in this movie. And I think that's part of the fun of this movie and seeing the people kind of berate the judge who, for in my opinion, is probably the most frustrating and hateful judge. In any movie that I've seen. I can't really think of another one.
No, I would agree. And I think, you know, that's partially because this judge is very involved. And I can't think of another time when a judge in a movie has been so involved in the proceedings.
Yeah, the closest one that I can think of is the judge from My Cousin Vinny, who is not a particularly bad person. I would argue that in the way that it's perceived in this movie, the Frank Langella judge is a bad and racist person. The judge in My Cousin Vinny is very traditional and butts against what is his name? Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci's character and his kind of more laid back style. But this guy is, I mean, it's a fantastic performance from Frank Langella, but he is so horrible so quickly. And it's actually amazing looking back at some of the records and seeing that some of the moments in this movie are things that he actually did.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into specifics, I'm sure, but I agree. Just it's so evil, it's so villainous that it's almost like cartoonish. But then,
yeah,
when you learn about it, you realize that it was real. This is true. This actually happened, and he was this evil. And there's just it's hard to sort of to accept it when you're watching the movie the first time. I think it could be a little distracting to viewers for him to be so villainous if you know nothing about this and you don't know that that's really how it went. You know, I think people could be distracted by how cartoonish he almost seems. So I almost think that maybe coming into it would be helpful to do a little brushing up and get a little knowledge of this story so that you're not sort of blindsided by that.
In the same way, the Abby Hoffman character played by Sacha Baron Cohen and the Jerry Rubin character are almost so cartoonishly hippie that you think that some of the things they do have to be completely made up, but there are actual things that happen in this movie that actually happened. And we'll talk about those in spoilers. But yeah, it is pretty crazy that some of this stuff did actually happen. But you mentioned that you looked into the transcripts and you kind of saw the more complex story that the trial of the Chicago 7 is. And obviously, all movies have to take liberties. But Aaron Sorkin is particularly, I don't know if notorious is the right word, but he is well known to take great liberties to tell a story. Like Social Network is not at all how that story went down. But is that something that's important for you in movies like this? Is it important for a historical drama to be more or less factual? Or do you think it's okay for them to take liberties just to tell a story? Like, it's clear that Sorkin is doing in this movie.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you look at The Social Network and that's universally praised. And I think it's a great film myself.
Yeah.
And it does take liberties. I think that when you look at this film, I think that it does take quite a few liberties, and I don't necessarily have issues with that because I understand, when I watched it again, I understand a lot of the reason why it went the way it did. But I also, there's a lot that I don't understand why it chose to do it the way it did, or why it chose not to explain things when it could have. And I think those, in my mind, if I can't explain it, if I can't explain the reason that you deviated from reality and it doesn't serve the story and it's not more entertaining, then I don't see why you did it. And for me, it's hard to justify that. And so I think that becomes an issue. But, you know, when it serves a purpose, when it's doing something to an end that this filmmaker is trying to get at, then I understand it. But I do at the same time sort of feel like this film is trying to present itself as fact. And I think that you need to be aware coming into this that this is an interpretation of these events, not what actually happened. And so I think that's difficult. That was a difficulty for me with this film in particular.
Do you have any general, non-specific, non-spoiler examples of that? I'm just curious about like what exactly you mean. But we can obviously talk about it more in spoilers.
Yeah, we might have to wait till spoilers because I think anything that I might say would be sort of on the edge of spoilers, and I don't want to, you know, maybe slip and give something away. So,
okay, cool. Well, let's go ahead and just kind of coast into spoilers then. Before we do, I do want to say that even though I absolutely do adore this movie, one of the things that I felt was weakest about the movie was the very end of it and how it kind of just ends in a way. And I think back to a lot of legal dramas and courtroom dramas and things, even like this year, like Just Mercy, that kind of end with a bang and end with a way that makes you feel like the impact of the story has a legacy that we're still feeling. And whether this actual trial does or does not have that, I'm sure it does, the movie doesn't really present it as such. It kind of just says, here's this story, this is the end, this is what happened to a couple of the characters, and then it doesn't really have any like great thing to say at the end. It's sort of like, okay, so what? And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad movie, but I did feel that it was kind of jarring to feel like the ultimate message of this movie, which, and I agree, I do think that there is a message here and there is stuff to be said that's interesting, but it's almost like secondhand to just, this is where we want to end the story because this is the end of the like entertainment part. And we just came to entertain for 2 hours.
That's sort of something I guess I'll point to with what's different between reality and the film. And I obviously we can talk more about the ending and spoilers, but the real closing arguments that Kunstler gives, like it's very eloquent. It's a quote from Clarence Darrow. And it speaks very much to the time that we're living in today. So it almost feels like the real ending of this case makes more sense to have been the ending of the movie. And so that it does, it is, it's strange to me why they chose to end the way they did.
Yeah, I don't totally know why either. I guess the one thing that I would say is that it's an easy power moment, you know? And definitely the way that this movie is structured is that it's not even like, we haven't even talked about how Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the prosecutor of this case. And in the film, he's not really the villain. The prosecution is not really the villain. Well, at least Joseph Gordon-Levitt isn't. And it's more this like establishment that is kind of the villain, yeah, and the judge manifesting that. So the end of this movie is definitely a fuck you to the judge, which feels really good given what we just watched for 2 hours because he's an awful, awful character. But there isn't a ton of like justice in that closing statement. I don't know. I do think like it's this is not a perfect film by any mean, but I do really love it. Do you want to go ahead and just wrap up your thoughts and then we'll hop into spoilers? And before we do that, just give a score out of 10.
So as far as the film goes, I think it's really entertaining. Like I said earlier, I think it's really fun. There's so much funny dialogue, witty dialogue, clever dialogue, that's just really entertaining to just listen to. And you know, regardless of what it's actually saying, it's just fun. And I do think that there is something deeper to it at the same time. I will agree with your point. I do think that the ending of this film is easy, and I had that sort of complaint a little bit with the film in general. I think occasionally it takes the easy way out, or it does something very easy rather than trying to look at this situation in maybe a little bit more complicated of way. Sometimes it does go into that, and I think that's sort of the problem for me with this film, considering some of Aaron Sorkin's previous works, is that he has done things that are more complex than this and that speak to something in a more complicated and engaging way. And to see this sort of miss the mark a few times, I think that was difficult for me. So all that being said, I do really like this film. This is easily the best film that we've reviewed together. there's that. So in the end, I think I'll give it an 8 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm going to echo most of that. I think the one thing I want to say about that, like, the idea that this movie takes kind of the easy way out is I agree with that assessment. And for me, that's sort of what I wanted out of this in a way, because I just, you know, it's just an entertaining movie and it's easy to feel good in this movie. And in that way, I think this movie is actually an excellent Oscar movie, because most Oscar movies are really easy and they kind of feign importance. Not that this isn't an important story, but this movie does kind of have this false idea of importance, in the same way that something – actually, I'm not going to compare it to the GB, but because
– It's not that.
Yeah, it's not problematic in ways. But I just do think that, like, this is going to be very well liked by the Academy, because it does kind of feel like an of-the-time movie, even if it's not saying everything that it could. But regardless of that, like Brett said, it's funny, it's clever, the acting is fantastic. I just really love it, and I really am excited to watch it again and again. So I'm going to give it a 9.5 out of 10. So with that, let's go ahead and take a break here, and when we return, we'll hop into spoilers.
Hi, I'm Christina Yerling-Biro, host of the podcast Pop Culture Confidential. Join me as I go way behind the scenes with some of the most influential people in entertainment and media. Hear actors such as Succession's Brian Cox talk about his favorite characters to play.
There always has to be a mystery. The audience have to be in a situation where they want to know what's going on.
Meet studio execs like Pixar chief Pete Docter and learn his secret on how he makes us cry.
Emotion is our first language.
And so many others who are defining popular culture, from Obama speechwriter David Litt to Top Chef host Padma Lakshmi.
We don't often think about food politically, or we don't want to, but it really is.
Join me. Search for Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we're back, and with that is your spoiler warning for The Trial of the Chicago 7, starting now.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
So, Brett, I want to throw it to you right away and just ask, what are some of those specific moments that you thought were kind of weird that they changed from the actual trial proceedings?
So I think the biggest thing, the couple of things I guess that I would focus on are the order of events. And so things happened in the trial in a very different order than they happened in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was a little confused why they ended up going the way they did. And I get to some extent having Abbie Hoffman on the stand at the end, being that final thing, that final moment. I mean, not the end, but having him have sort of the final say. But, you know, overall, they just sort of, it felt like they didn't have to do things the way they did, or they just created some things, like Attorney General Clark. He was always on the defendant list. Mm-hmm. Apparently the defense actually tried to subpoena President Johnson. He didn't do it. He didn't appear, but apparently they tried to do that. I think this film tried to make it seem more clear cut than it was, especially with Attorney General Clark's testimony, because in reality, it's never said, like, in the actual transcript, and he never comes out and actually says, hey, we weren't going to charge these people. We found that the police had done it. Like, it never gets that far in the actual trial, because the prosecution just keeps objecting and objecting and objecting, and he can't actually get a question that the prosecution and the judge will allow him to answer. And so I don't see the point of making it so clear cut, except unless you're just trying to spin this story, to tell the story you want it to tell. Because I think having the prosecution just object over and over and over again gets the same point across. Mm-hmm. It might not be like as huge of a moment, but it just felt like you're trying to turn the story into something that it wasn't. And that was difficult for me. As far as the Bobby Seale thing, where his lawyer, you know, he was sick. And that's real. That happened. But, as far as the case, there seems to be, and I only looked over the case for like 3 hours. It's 22,000 pages long. So clearly I didn't get through the whole thing. But it seems to be that there's some sort of procedural thing going on underneath this that's beyond just this argument of constitutionality. And I wish that the film had addressed that, because I think in Bobby Seale's appeal, he does get it overturned. Like, it was procedurally wrong to not allow him to have his lawyer, but there was something in the case that seemed like the judge felt like he was justified by law of doing it. And I felt like in the film, it just seemed like he was being ridiculous. And I wish that maybe something more had been addressed there, rather than just trying to make the judge look like a clown, I guess. Because it was something that just confused me when I was watching the film, rather than maybe made me laugh like it was supposed to. And so those are just like a few things that I noticed quickly reading through. But a lot of the testimony is taken straight from the case. So there are word for word excerpts that are in the film.
Yeah. So like when Justice Hoffman clarifies that he and Abby Hoffman have no relation, and then Abby Hoffman says, "Father, no," like that actually happened. I read about that seems like something that is so ridiculous that if it was in a fictional story, people would be like, that's pretty unrealistic. And it actually happened.
Yeah. I mean, that's for sure true. But even looking like at more dark things, like when the judge says, take him into another room and deal with him as he should be or whatever, that's word for word what he legitimately said to these bailiffs when they dragged Bobby Seale out of the courtroom. So,
yeah, I do think that the Bobby Seale character in general and how this movie treats him is very cut and dry, or it's very simplified. And I think the reason for that is that there is so much more going on, just not even just like procedurally, but also just like the idea that Bobby Seale is in jail and all the white defendants get to be off on bail, and all these clearly systematically racist things that are in place here are just barely mentioned. And two, I guess in defense of Aaron Sorkin, is that that's not the story that he necessarily wants to or is capable of telling. But that does definitely feel like something that was sidelined in this movie. And that's where a lot of the nuance could have come from this story and could have been a bit more effective, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think there are some good moments that arise from that. But I agree. I think it's very much something that Aaron Sorkin seems to have wanted to address. It seems to have wanted to say something about it, but also sort of say, this isn't the story that I'm trying to tell. And so Bobby Seale leaves, and sort of the presence of any black actors also leaves from the film. And I think that's it's definitely a difficult thing to accept, I think, when you're watching this film, is that, you know, he's there and then he's gone, and then any presence of sort of diversity also disappears from this film. I would like to believe, and I mean, he's been writing sociopolitical commentaries for longer than I've been alive. So I would hope that he's sort of trying to be tactful and respectful, rather than try to get into this this conversation that he, like you said, isn't really equipped to have.
Yeah, there's one moment that I thought really stood out to me with the Bobby Seale character on the second watch that I didn't really think about on the first watch, and that's the scene when Kunstler and Tom go visit him in prison to tell him that his friend has been murdered. And Bobby Seale directly addresses Tom and said, "You guys all have the same father. All you white people, like, you are doing this as a fuck you to your father." And Tom admits, it's a little bit that. And then Bobby Seale says this fantastic line that's like, "You see how that's different than a rope in a tree, right?" And that line alone just gets into something that could be an entire movie in and of itself. Like the difference between these people who are trying to fight the Vietnam War versus what the Black Panthers and MLK were doing. And just that idea is something that this movie just barely touches. And I could see why people might be frustrated that that's not the main focus of this story, because that is, in a lot of ways, the most interesting part of this whole thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, but again, I think, like I said, I think that Aaron Sorkin just didn't, that wasn't his story. And I think that maybe, hopefully, someday someone who can tell that story will. And then maybe we'll have another trial of the Chicago Seven that we can we can watch.
Yeah, yeah. What I do like that this film focuses more on is the war of ideals between Tom Hayden and Abbie Hoffman. I think all of that is really fascinating. And I just love how both of them can be right and both of them can be wrong. And the movie doesn't necessarily tell you this person's right, this person's wrong. It's more nuanced than that. I like that.
Yeah, I agree. That's another sort of that's something that is different from reality. That was something that made sense to change between the film and real life, so that you could have these two sort of competing forces that are going toward the same end goal, but have very different ideas of how you should get there, and the difficulties that each side has, and what's right about each side and what's wrong about each side, like you said. And so, you know, you get that final confrontation between the two of them where they sort of air it all out. And that sort of shows even that there's a divide within our different ideologies, and there's all of these divides that we all have, and maybe we need to just be able to look at each other and understand, you know, where we're all coming from and the differences that we bring. And I think that that's probably the most effective part of this film is sort of the two of them. And so I know you said you had a question on the prep sheet, I guess, for this, where you asked what two actors would I pick if they, you know, if only two could be award contenders. And I think that's the reason why I would pick Eddie Redmayne and Sacha Baron Cohen, because I think they represent the ideologies that are central to this film. And I think they do a really good job on top of that. But I think that they're the main idea that this film is trying to get across.
Do you think they would do best actors for both of them and compete against each other? Or can one be a supporting actor?
I don't know. I think everyone in this film is a supporting actor, to be honest. I don't know that anyone is lead, but those two, I think, would be the closest thing you could call to a lead actor.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? I'm not even going to try to figure that out.
I think it kind of just depends on what the studio wants to run them as, to be honest. Like, these award contention things are bullshit. Like, sometimes there's a supporting actor that's clearly a lead, and other times there's a lead actor that's clearly supporting. But I think they'll definitely, I think Sacha Baron Cohen is the runaway, like, one who could actually do something from this movie in terms of the acting noms. I think he's fantastic. And so that would be my first pick. And then actually my second pick is going to be Frank Langella, just because I think what he's doing as the judge is fantastic. You know, it's a cliche to say that, like, the movie's only as good as its villain, but you need that performance to be despisable for this movie to work. So I think it's a fantastic performance. I just wanted to, like, in spoilers, I just wanted to mention some, like, absolutely amazing lines that are in this movie, because I think specifically the Mark Rylance character has just some fantastic little clapbacks that are just so funny. And I love so much of the dialogue in this movie. Some of my favorite ones are when they're all complaining about replacing the juror that essentially the prosecution kind of threatened and removed. Mark Rylance asks or says, "Raise your hand if you've ever shown up to jury duty." "No? Then shut the fuck up." And just the way that he's so comfortable with telling, like, the people he's working for to shut the fuck, it's so funny.
That's one of my favorite lines in the whole movie.
Yeah. And then he also has a line to the woman who works at the conspiracy office, where she says, "Most people are smart." And he says, "If you believe that, you'll be heartbroken every day of your life." And I think that's good advice to live by in these times.
Yeah. Lee Weiner has a couple, you know, for a character who has like maybe five lines in the whole film, he has a couple really good lines. I know you had one written down.
Yeah. Go ahead. Do you want to take it?
No, you go ahead. Because it's not the one I'm thinking of.
Well, so there's a moment when the judge Hoffman feels like he is being accused of racism by Mark Rylance's character. And he says that, you know, "I've been practicing law for 25 years and this is the first time that anyone has ever accused me of racism." And then without step, classic Aaron Sorkin, Lee Weiner, like second defender, says, "Then let the record show that I am the second." And it's so vindicating. Just the way that Frank Langella looks after that, like he's just been kind of like, no one has ever talked to him like that. It's so good. And you know people like that too, you know? Like, there are people that just are so blind to not even explicit racism, even though this guy is very clearly explicitly racist. But, like, so many people are like, "Oh, I've never been called racist. I can't believe you're doing it." Such a good clapback. I loved it.
Yeah.
What's your line?
That's actually Wineglass's co-counsel, but Weiner is one of the defendants.
Oh, whoops. Oh, wait, did I pull a Judge Hoffman and say the wrong name?
Yes, you did.
My bad. I was talking about Wineglass. You're right. You're talking about one of the defendants, Weiner. Sorry, continue.
So they have that confrontation, and then Jeremy Strong's character, I can't remember anybody's names right now for some reason. He talks about the Jack and the Beanstalk, and they're all arguing about this. And he's like, you know, the giant might have ate him at the end. And then the other guy's like, "No, I think the giant was nice." And then Lee Weiner's like, I don't remember the exact words, but it was something like, "I can't imagine how we weren't able to stop, the seven of us weren't able to stop a war."
Yeah. It is really, yeah. I love that Weiner character because he's so, like you said, he's got five lines, and this is probably confusing for people who are listening because I completely mixed up the two characters. But the Weiner character, the line that I have written for him that you're referring to is when there's just a montage of all the informants that are testifying on him, and it gets cut back to like all the people that are like, "Yo, I'm your guy for booze, ass, and weed. Hit me up." And then it just cuts immediately to that guy on the stand, and he's like, "I'm the police officer for the Chicago 7th District," or whatever. And it is so funny, but at the very end of this whole montage of all these informants, the Weiner character turns to his friend and says, "Do you think it's possible that there were 7 demonstrators in Chicago last summer leading 10,000 undercover cops in protest?" I rolled laughing the first time.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorite parts about this film. That was definitely the dialogue. And you've got great actors who are able to deliver the dialogue really well. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's just so much fun.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's the ultimate thing about this movie, the ultimate recommendation. And I think for like a time like now, you keep saying it's of the moment, but even just in terms of like feeling good in a movie, can't take away that feeling. So this is a great movie in my opinion.
The one thing that I will say about this, I guess, and if we wanted to talk more, we can afterward or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is a film that there is so much going on in this, to just in terms of the filmmaking quality in terms of the writing, in terms of the acting. Like, you can talk about it as a film and you can appreciate those aspects of it. But there's also a lot you can talk about in this film in terms of comparing it to reality. You can, you know, there's so many different things that are different from real life. And to go through all of those things and try to discern what Aaron Sorkin was thinking, like, why did he do these things? I think that's a really interesting aspect of this. And to me, it's really fun. I mean, I don't know if fun's the right word, but it's really fun after watching a true story movie to kind of do that deep dive and see, you know, what the real story is and what this film was trying to do with that real story. So there's a lot to like here. And I just want to end on that note, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, we could easily go for the length of this movie times two and go point by point and talk about everything. And you're right. There's so much in this movie and it is trying to say so much, or I mean, I don't even know. Like, I think what's interesting about the movie is that it can say so much, but it's very clear that Aaron Sorkin made this script to be a film. And I think maybe that's a stupid thing to say. Of course he did. Of course he wrote the film script to be a film. But I just mean that, like, there is so much clear development in terms of giving us the information that we need in setup in Act 1, and then raising the stakes in Act 2, and then having the resolution in Act 3. And even if that's not quite how factually the story went, it is just very clearly shaped to be a rise and fall story and be exciting and be satisfying. And I think that's difficult to do. I think that's one of the hardest parts of adapting a story like this, and why Aaron Sorkin is so good at these courtroom dramas.
Mm-hmm. And of course, like I said, the actual trial transcript is 22,000 pages long. So to get that down to 2 hours,
yeah,
with some background extraneous stuff going on, you know, you gotta give him credit for that, at least.
Yeah, I just was reading up on the guy who wrote the Goblet of Fire screenplay, and he was like, yeah, you know, it was really hard trimming down 670 pages of the Goblet of Fire into a 2-hour movie. And I was like, buddy, calm down. This is 22,000 pages over here. So it's definitely a testament. And the fact that the movie works at all is great. With that, let's go ahead and move on to our point two section, where we talk about some of the other stuff that we've been watching. Brett, what have you been watching other than The Trial of the Chicago 7?
So I have been watching, and I don't know if I've told you where I'm going to law school, but I am attending law school at Notre Dame.
Oh, nice.
The thing that has been on literally everyone's television for the past week has been obviously the confirmation hearing for Amy Coney Barrett, because she was a professor here. She went here. And so I watched all 24 hours-ish of that. Yeah, that's what I've been watching. I won't get into my thoughts about, you know, should they even be having this the hearing, or should she be confirmed? But yeah, I will say that it's not something I would recommend to anyone to ever sit and watch 24 hours of a Senate confirmation hearing, because politicians are the worst. But and then also this weekend I did get the chance to watch a couple of films from the Middleburg Film Festival. So I watched Wolfwalkers, which is an animated film.
Oh, nice. How was that?
I thought it was really good, and I'll say that I definitely noticed that there are some flaws in it. It has some familiarity to sort of fantastical animated films, but it is a very, it's not, I won't say unique, I guess, art style, but it's very different from what we normally see in terms of art style. I really like sort of this fantastical, this historical Gaelic element, because it's an Irish film. It's an Irish story that it's telling, and it's a really touching film, and it takes a lot of steps that I guess you'll expect coming into it, but I think it does it really well. And it has like a nice central message there. It's almost Pixar-y, I guess, and it's sort of, you know, it knows what it wants to say. It has these emotional moments throughout, but it's in a very different art style, and it's very unique in that way, I guess, of being a feeling not American almost.
Yeah.
So I definitely recommend Wolfwalkers.
That's coming to Apple TV Plus, right?
Yep. It is currently my favorite animated film of the year so far. So
holding out for Soul.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if Soul can beat it. I did give Wolfwalkers 9 out of 10. So
damn.
Yeah, I did like it more than this one. I also watched Minari.
Oh man, so there was a virtual screening of this, and I wanted to get it, so I bought the tickets. And then, like, I put all my credit card information in, and they were like, "Oh, we're sold out." And I was like, "Well, crap! Did you charge me?" And they ended up not. But I was so upset that I like went through the whole thing, and I was so pumped to get to see this because I've heard so many good things about it. But
yeah,
I have to wait.
Well, I won't spoil anything for you anyway.
Yeah,
definitely recommend that you watch it. It is very good. I gave it an 8 out of 10, like I gave Trial of Chicago 7, but I will also say that at the same time, personally, like if I weren't looking at it as a critic and just how I felt about the film, then it could arguably be my favorite film of the year. So definitely someone to try to see at some point.
Okay, sweet. I hyped you up for Trial of the Chicago 7, so now you're hyping me up for Minari.
Yeah.
Really looking forward to that one. Whenever I get a chance to see it, who knows,
man. Yeah, hopefully it doesn't let you down.
Yeah. So I actually haven't been watching too much. Somehow I've kind of gotten off watching a bunch. Just really slowed down in the last month in terms of watching things. But I did, on Amazon Prime Day, get a whole bunch of these like box set things. So I got like the 4K releases of the entire Dark Knight trilogy for like $20. And I got all these packaged film sets. And one of them was like the self-proclaimed ultimate Alfred Hitchcock film collection. And it comes with 15 of Alfred Hitchcock's films. And I have never seen an Alfred Hitchcock film. So I watched the very first one yesterday. And we chose Rope, because Rope is an hour and 20 minutes. So I thought it was a great intro.
I do want to. I just think we ought to wait till after you graduate.
I don't.
It's only a month.
Janet, a month?
Please.
Sorry. I personally consider us engaged as of now. Congratulations.
David, no.
Look, you can say yes in a taxi. I have a 2:30 appointment.
I'm staying right here.
Oh, afraid you'll say yes?
I'll see you tonight at Brandon's party.
Okay. You can say yes, sir, just as well as in a taxi. Goodbye, darling.
Five.
That's the last time she ever saw him alive. And that's the last time you'll ever see him alive. What happened to David Kentley changed my life completely and the lives of 7 others.
It's a fantastic film. This is a film, it stars James Stewart, like most Alfred Hitchcock films, but it also stars John Dahl and Farley Granger. And basically the premise of this is that in the very opening scene, the two men played by Dahl and Granger, they kill one of their friends in their apartment by strangling him with a piece of rope. And then they put him inside of a chest in the middle of the room. And then the rest of the film takes place in this one apartment, and they host a dinner party, which includes the man that they murdered's parents, his girlfriend, and his best friend. Brett, have you seen Rope?
I have not, but I know this. This is a very famous, very famous setup that people talk about as sort of the go-to idea of sort of having that dramatic irony of having the audience know something that none of the characters know.
Yeah, the basic idea behind this whole setup is that this is a sadistic plan by these two guys to pull off the perfect murder. The whole reason that they do this is to see if they can get away with it. Because in their minds, murder is something that can be done by the select brilliant few. And, you know, if you kill people who are stupid, then it doesn't really matter, basically. And so it's a very Randian idea that, you know, the smartest people can do whatever they want. But the whole movie, I said it's 80 minutes, but it's shot like a one take and it's all in real time. And I looked it up and it's actually only comprised of 10 long shots. So the entire movie is just 10 long shots and then they're stitched together, you know, by like panning past somebody's coat that makes the screen dark or whatever.
Movie magic.
But yeah, exactly. But it makes for a really suspenseful film. It's a really engaging film. I thought it was fantastic. And it's just really fun because the whole time you're watching, you're like, A, are they going to get away with it? And B, do I want them to get away with it? Like, is there some part of me that's like, it'd be kind of cool if they just got away with this, even though this is super fucked up. And it's fun because the two guys, they're pitted against James Stewart, who is their previous headmaster at school, who's who they consider as kind of like an intellectual equal. And so they kind of almost want him to almost find out and they want him to almost see what they're doing to like show how clever they are. And it's just a lot of fun. I definitely recommend it. And especially as a really short film, I think it's a great intro to older films and Hitchcock films.
Yeah, I think that's something, I haven't seen a lot of Hitchcock films myself either, but I think that's something that's really interesting about Hitchcock's films is that they tend to make you think about yourself as a viewer when you're watching the film and what you think about what's going on top of just engaging with what's going on. And I can appreciate sort of that level of filmmaking to have you sort of like with Rear Window, the, you know, the idea of voyeurism, and you kind of have a kind of question because it's very much something that I think everybody does is just kind of people watch it. And so there's, you know, I think, and then like you said here, do you want them to get away with it? I think the questions that you ask yourself are almost as interesting with Hitchcock's films as the questions that you ask about the film.
Yeah, the Rear Window is the next one that I want to watch. And then North by Northwest, of course, Psycho, all of those are in the box set. Vertigo, all of those big ones. And then, of course, there's some of the lesser known ones that I'm dying to check out. So I think already it's been worth the, like, I think it was $40 or something for 15 films. So, yeah, I mean, I'd highly recommend the box set. It looks great. For being from the 40s, of course. And yeah, you know, I'm really excited to get to see like all of these films for the first time. All right. This has been our review of The Trial of the Chicago 7. Brett, thanks so much for joining me. Is there anything specific that you want to plug here?
Nope. I still don't have anything going on. I'm almost finished with semester one of 1L year. So I don't know if I'm going to get back into doing reviews after I'm done. Maybe I'll just relax for a little while.
God forbid.
Yeah. So, yeah, you can follow me at Bohan Reviews on Twitter. But other than that, don't expect me to be doing a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. The intro music for this episode is a piece called Work by Kevin MacLeod, and you can find more of his work at incompetech.com. If you'd like to keep up with this podcast and find out when we release new episodes, you can follow us on Twitter at MovieMeraPod or on Facebook at facebook.com/MovieMeraPod. That's Movie M-A-R-A Pod. And you can always reach out to us at our email, MovieMarathonersPod@gmail.com. You can find more episodes of this podcast at our website, evergreenpodcasts.com/movie-marathoners. And we are also on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, Overcast, Himalaya, and CastBox. So please subscribe or write a review if you like what we're doing, and any feedback you have to help improve the podcast is always appreciated. So thank you all for listening, and we hope you'll join us again next time when I'm joined by my girlfriend Dana to celebrate the Halloween season a bit by talking about the first four Harry Potter films. So I think that's going to be a really fun conversation. It's going to be a lot of nitpicking about movies that we know really well, so stay tuned for that. Until then, remember that life's a marathon, so let's take it one movie at a time.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Calafato, and I'm the creator of 7-Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.